From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Namdi. Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with Melinda Miles. She is the mayor of a town in Maryland that we've been debating the correct pronunciation of the name of, whether it's Mount Rainier or Mount Rainier. That's the first thing she'll clear up when she comes on. Our guest right now is Tom Perriello. He's a Democratic candidate for Virginia governor. He's a former member of Congress representing Virginia's 5th District. Tom Perriello, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter with NBC4 and a columnist with the Current newspapers. Tom Perriello, I should tell you, on several occasions when we have had candidates for office here, at the end of the broadcast, we've taken photos with them, and Tom Sherwood invariably says, do not use this photo in your campaign materials. What we do not say is, do not ever quote me in your campaign materials. And we expressly do not say, do not ever misquote me or quote me out of context in your campaign materials. Well, that apparently happened in this Virginia Democratic governor's contest when Tom was quoted out of context.
I was inaccurately quoted.
Tell us the story.
It wasn't even quoted. I was made up.
Not by our campaign.
No. Let's be clear before. So I moderated the debate last Saturday in Fairfax County.
That's in the middle of everything, yes.
With Ralph Northam and our guest, Tom Perriello. And then I wrote a column about it. And in it, I had said, one of the sentences was that many people, I think many people is a correct phrase, thought that Ralph Northam, with his experience and his position, was the right person for the Democrats this time around. And polling and stuff has shown a lot of that. So I thought it was a reasonable thing to say in the column. Well, the Northam campaign sent out the column correctly, but put a headline on there saying that me, Tom Sherwood, said that Northam was the right candidate. As soon as I saw it online, I immediately called and messaged and texted and did everything else. And to the Northam's credit, the campaign put out a correction right away and I didn't quite apologize for having done it. Just said they didn't mean to characterize what I had said, but the headline certainly did. As I said to them, I value my integrity, my reputation. When I write that column, you may not like it, but I think I do it in a proper way. In over 20 years, I might add.
Did you get an angry phone call from one Tom Perriello saying, Sherwood, how could you possibly say that?
This is Virginia. We don't have angry phone calls. Ian Sams, one of his press guys, you know, has been very polite in calling attention to various things, but that's his job, and he's done it well.
As I said, he is our guest.
I have to say, Sams and I, you know, we have a connection from Johnson City, Tennessee, which we're not going to tell. You'll have to look it up.
And an Alabama connection.
In Alabama.
So that's a whole lot of Southern civility coming.
But enough of that.
There.
The thing is, campaigns need, if they're going to quote the media, the Richmond Times-Dispatch did a story on this today. But if a campaign is going to quote somebody in the media, please be careful that you are as accurate as the media is, which is not a very high standard.
Well, before we go to Virginia politics again, I have to discuss very briefly what happened in Congress this week with the D.C. pro-marijuana laws, and that is the annual budget of Congress already had an amendment in it that prohibits the D.C. government from using any of its budget funds to regulate marijuana. And some of the activists, pro-marijuana activists in the district, had said, well, if we can't use the budget funds, maybe we could use something from the reserve. And apparently, Republican Congressman Andy Harris of Maryland, who has his ears to the ground on these D.C. politics issues, heard about that and immediately inserted into the amendment, you cannot use your reserve funds for this either. We should mention that we have, as we have on many occasions in the past, invited Congressman Andy Harris to join us on this broadcast. So far, he has not accepted.
He can find his way into city politics, but not his way to Connecticut Avenue. That's okay. He's congressman. He's entitled to do what he wants to do. The city has nearly $2 billion in the bank. It's one of the healthiest local governments in the country. And this marijuana ban, every year the Congress appropriates money in its budget, and it says you may not spend any of these funds to regulate the sale or promotion of marijuana. Well, the city people were saying, and they said it all too publicly, which I would criticize the city folks for this. You know, you shouldn't say these things publicly. You should just do it. They said, well, we'll use some of the reserve fund money. We won't use this year's appropriation. Well, Andy Harris put in a qualifier saying you can't use any money you have. And so that's where we stand.
Our guest is Tom Perriello. He's a Democratic candidate for Virginia governor, former member of Congress representing Virginia's 5th District. If you have questions or comments, you can call 800-433-8850 or send email to kojo@wamu.org. Go to our website, kojoshow.org. Watch the live video stream of the broadcast. Ask a question or make a comment or shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show. The House of Representatives passed a bill yesterday to override the Affordable Care Act. Its fate in the Senate is uncertain, but as written, it will have a big impact on Medicaid. Your first TV ads began this week, one of them featuring you talking about congressional Republicans trying to repeal and replace Obamacare. It has you standing behind an ambulance that is being crushed into scrap metal by a huge car crusher, with you talking. Did you film that in one take, or do you have to crush multiple ambulances to do it?
It was a very nerve-wracking take, I won't lie. Luckily, I was in front of the ambulance, not behind the ambulance, or in the ambulance. But no, we did have to do that in one take. And, you know, while advertisements can sometimes require a little bit of artistry or gimmickry, we're trying to make a very serious point. And the fact of the matter is, this is a massive step backwards for affordable care and universal care coverage in the country and in the Commonwealth of Virginia. It's been estimated that 600,000 Virginians could lose their care under this step taken by the Republicans in Congress. And by changing the essential benefits package, which was one of the best accomplishments of the Affordable Care Act, it guaranteed things like pre- and postnatal care. So the cost of seeing a pregnancy through to term in Virginia could go up $15,000 per family in Virginia. The issue of having pre-existing conditions creeps back into our system. The cost of mammogram screenings go up. And you see really a 10-year backward step of trying to hold the insurance companies accountable on things like lifetime caps. Now, it is true, as currently written, and we're all trying to get through it since many of the congresspeople who voted for the bill admitted that they had not even read the bill, had not had the courage to hold a single hearing on the bill where their constituents or experts could talk about this. We don't know all the details, but it does appear that much of the changes would require legislative action in Richmond, and therefore this governor's race is even more important than ever, which is to have a governor who would be able to veto any of these steps backwards on pre-existing conditions and the essential benefits package. I was very proud to vote for the Affordable Care Act in Congress.
Have cost you your seat, didn't it?
It may have, but, you know, it saved a lot of lives, and that's why I've never regretted it. And every week, you know, when I'm through the district and elsewhere, people tell me their stories about how, you know, they had a child born with a condition and would have bankrupted the family, but the lifetime cap removal has been a life changer for them. And, you know, I think of all their faces yesterday as that vote goes through and how many of them are worried about whether that will no longer be the case or the next 10 years of people whose health care would be affected by the kinds of things that you just can't predict are going to happen to you.
Tom? Virginia senators and Sherwood? Republican senators are all saying that this bill is essentially dead on arrival in Senate, but it does fire a warning shot to places like Virginia, the city of Washington, the mayor saying that we could have a $1 billion expense if we tried to cover issues that are in health care. As governor, would there be much that you can do? I mean, you'd have to work with the legislature, obviously, to maybe make up for some of the losses. The bill, maybe that's going to, if it one passes at all, may not be as bad as the House bill is seen now by the people who oppose it. But do you think as governor there will be much you'll be able to do to address the health care issue? And if so, what?
Well, it's hard to know what will happen in the Senate because a lot of the people predicting it's dead on arrival in the Senate are the same ones who said Trump could never win the nomination, Trump could never win the election, and that this was already dead in the House. So I think we have to remain vigilant. I do think the organizing at the community level that has been done across Virginia and communities across the country have had a real effect on slowing down the killing of Obamacare, and I think it could have an effect on preventing the Senate from moving this forward. But I would not rule anything out. If we do see this disastrous type of bill move forward, then I do think at the state level first on those things that would need to change, like the essential benefit packages and pre-existing conditions, I do think a governor who people know has already stood up to the insurance companies before and the drug companies before, like myself, could be there to veto changes in the legislation. The other thing people have to remember is there were a number of things about this bill that had nothing to do with health care. One was that this is a massive tax cut that is being passed through of about a third of $1 trillion, and not one penny of that tax cut goes to anyone making less than $200,000 a year. So this was really Paul Ryan's dream, I think, of an unpaid-for massive tax cut for the richest Virginians, and specifically a tax cut primarily on capital gains versus earned income, which continues a tradition in America pointing in the wrong direction that actually punishes more earned labor over those capital gains. The other big factor here is that this bill never would have passed without radical gerrymandering at the state level in Virginia and around the country. We have to remember this is not a Congress that represents the majority of Americans. In fact, several of the last midterm congressional cycles, more votes were cast for Democrats than for Republicans in House seats. This reflects an algorithm that was written by K Street lobbyists to make sure that those lobbying interests were protected instead of the majority view, and that's why you see a Congress insulated.
You and your Democratic opponent, Lieutenant Governor Ralph Northam, have squared off in quite a few debates. One of them, as we mentioned earlier, moderated by Tom Sherwood last week.
Brilliantly.
It was
brilliantly
noted
moderate.
For its civility, with the exception of the moderator. One of the few areas of difference, or one of the areas of difference, seemed to be over Dominion, Virginia's power company, both about future pipelines and about campaign contributions from that company. What are the issues for you?
Well, this came up again in last night's debate down in Roanoke, and we really hope people will go on to WDBJ and watch the whole debate last night. I think it's so valuable when people get a full hour of hearing the differences, and there were a lot of them last night. One has been that we are the only candidate who's refused to take contributions from Dominion Power, the electric utilities, and the publicly regulated monopolies. Dr. Northam has taken about $100,000 from Dominion and refused to answer a simple question in the debate about whether he had had secret meetings with Dominion before submitting his position on the pipeline. He refused again last night to speak to that after saying he believed in transparency in this process. And we have to understand, these pipelines are not just a $6.7 billion boondoggle where they haven't even proved the economic need for these. It's not just a climate issue, though it is certainly that. It's not just an eminent domain issue where this is really using eminent domain for corporate gain in Virginia. It's also about the jobs of the future. There are more people working today, Americans working today, in clean energy than in fossil fuel energy. And this is about small businesses versus consolidated power. Virginia's been losing the solar industry to North Carolina. We're quickly losing the wind industry to Maryland because Dominion has bought up the wind rights offshore and are sitting them, putting them on a shelf to collect dust. So this is really about whether we're looking to the next generation of jobs and ideas or stuck in the old model where a very small number of players can spend a lot of money on both political parties and really hold Virginia back from that kind of economic growth and climate protection.
I'd like to go to the phones. We'd like to start with Gail in Alexandria, Virginia. Put on your headphones, please. Gail, you are on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. Mr. Perriello, I'm an Alexandria resident, and I noticed that you did not vote in our 2015 election. We had a primary for our state delegate, and then we had the general election for state delegate and city council, and you were completely absent. And I haven't seen you around town at Democratic events or charitable events. I haven't seen you at major Democratic events in Virginia throughout the state for the past few years until you declared you're running. So why didn't you vote in 2015?
Yeah, thanks, Gail. I know you asked an extended number of questions at the forum the other night, which I appreciate. And I think that engagement with the Democratic Party at the local level is incredibly important. At the time, I was working for the Democratic President of the United States. I was under Hatch Act restrictions of how much politicking I could do, and I take those legal restrictions very seriously. But I do believe from helping to run Center for American Progress and advancing a progressive agenda both in Virginia and around the country after leaving Congress, and supporting not just President Obama's reelection, but election on a really much more progressive and aggressive platform that I think was crucial to that victory. And then going in to serve in that administration is extremely valuable. And I think a lot of Democrats appreciate that. I think right now we have not only great energy in the Democratic Party, but we have great energy in the movements and a lot of folks who've spent the last 20 years trying to fight poverty and trying to push for criminal justice reform and may or may not be members of their local Democratic committees. And I think it's important right now that we try to be as inclusive as possible, that those folks who have, you know, been supportive of these causes are really embraced and that we build a larger bridge. And I can tell you, you know, if this becomes a loyalty test in this primary about commitment to the Democratic Party, that's certainly a test we're more than happy to apply, given the fact that Ralph Northam has admitted voting for George W. Bush twice and said he couldn't even remember whether he had supported either Tim Kaine or Mark Warner in their races. So I think for a lot of Democrats, certainly showing up to vote is very important, but making sure you actually vote for Democrats once you get to the polls is even more important. And I think a lot of Democrats have expressed deep concern about Lieutenant Governor Northam's commitment to the party and its principles, given, again, those votes for George W. Bush, not just the first time, but after so many terrible things that had happened in those first 4 years, going back to the polls to cast that vote again.
Gail, thank you very much for your call. In case you're wondering, we will be having all of the Virginia candidates for governor on the show in the coming weeks. Next week, we'll be featuring Republican Corey Stewart, who is the Prince William chair of the Prince William County Board of Supervisors, Tom.
Well, I like the hearing that answer because in January, you know, I pressed the gentleman here on draw a contrast, not be negative, but to draw a contrast with Mr. Northam. And you said you were going to run a positive campaign. I said, there's a difference between contrast and negative, and you just did it. I mean, this we just talked about it. There's only 5 weeks to go in this campaign. You got started late. You're not as well known. Don't have as much money. But you are also part of the mood in the country of Democrats trying to be re-energized because of the Trump win last year and the Congress and what it's doing, like health care. But you're asking the Democratic voters in Virginia to turn against the current governor, Terry McAuliffe.
Who has endorsed
Mr. Northam. You're asking the state's two senators, Mark Warner, Tim Kaine, the vice presidential candidate last year for the Democrats, who have endorsed Ralph Northam. Now, they endorsed before you got into the race. But aren't you, what's wrong with the state Democratic Party that the establishment is so bad that all its top leaders are endorsing Ralph Northam? That you have an upstart campaign, that's a high hurdle for you.
Well, apparently it's not that high of a hurdle because we're ahead in the polls, but I think it's about the strength of the party. It's about the strength of those leaders, and I think it's about the strength in the Democratic Party of having an honest debate about ideas. You know, before we got in this race, people weren't talking about a lot of these issues, and they are now. We're the first campaign in Virginia history to run for a $15 an hour minimum wage, for 8 weeks of paid family and medical leave, first campaign to run on 2 years of debt-free community college, trade school, or apprenticeship program. And put forward a tax reform proposal, which even conservatives have noted have been very specific and real in their reforms, and paid for every penny of universal pre-K, of the 2 years of community college, the 8 weeks of medical leave, and a student refinance program to help reduce the monthly payments. We've also put out an aggressive platform on criminal justice reform and closing the racial wealth gap here in Virginia, where the median net worth of an African-American family remains 1/11th that of the median white family. So I think the reason that our campaign has pulled ahead and caught so much grassroots fire is because people are excited about the two things we're doing. We've both led on resisting the agenda of hate and bigotry from the right, White House, but also led on a positive agenda of economic opportunity and dignity that leaves no race or region behind.
What's the evidence that you're ahead in the polls?
The last Quinnipiac poll that was run statewide had us up 5 points. The Christopher Newport poll, and again, we take all the polls with an asterisk.
Well, actually, the leader, though, was undecided, don't know.
Absolutely, and right. I think that's exactly the point here. Right. You know, you said at the beginning about being better known. One of the things that was shocking to me when I got in the race was the fact that we were actually known just as well as Ralph Northam was, despite the fact that he had been the statewide lieutenant governor for 3 years. So I think part of that is that people really appreciate the tough votes that I took when it really mattered on health care reform and on climate change, on the stimulus bill, on support for Planned Parenthood funding and LGBT rights while I was in Congress representing a very conservative district. I think I've been out getting the executive experience that you want to see in a governor, having overseen a strategic review of a $50 billion, 40,000 employee operation in the State Department and USAID. And I think it's because we're speaking to the challenges that are out there in the community. So we love the momentum that we've got.
I think, and I waited until you listed your votes in Congress, because, you know, your critics say, well, you've made that NRA vote, which you've repudiated.
And which you
made
vote?
The NRA vote, the assault weapons.
There was no vote. This is, again, going back to the Northam campaign being a little fast and loose with
the facts. I didn't get it from them. I thought I read it in the congressional. Wait, what is it? What is your position on the NRA? What was the position that people are...
They focus on the endorsement. But as I pointed out,
then you have an A plus rating.
Allow me to have Amy in Ashburn, Virginia, raise the question.
Sure.
Amy, okay. You're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Oh, great! Thank you so much. So, in 2010, after 32 teachers and students were murdered at Virginia Tech, you not only accepted thousands of dollars from the NRA and touted your A rating, but your campaign said, and I'm quoting here, that you consistently opposed reinstatement of the so-called assault weapons ban, among other gun control efforts. So can you discuss why you have pivoted on this issue when the NRA is still the same radical organization that it's always been?
Okay, he wrote a letter saying that it was an affront to the founding fathers to try to ban assault weapons.
So a few things on this. First, you know, there was not a major legislative push in those 2 years, either on assault weapons or on the universal background check. But when Democratic leaders were ready to take on that fight, I was right in the middle of it. I was the head of an organization that helped lead advocacy efforts on the outside, specifically targeting former NRA-endorsed members to try to finally get the universal background checks and closing of the gun show loophole. The NRA at that point responded to Sandy Hook by saying the answer to our gun crisis was more guns in more places, and continued to move in a more and more extreme direction over that time. We've continued to fight in this campaign for common sense gun reform, including the issue of high capacity magazines and the issue of assault weapons bans, because now the way that Connecticut and Maryland have written those bans, I think they have a much better chance of surviving, as we've seen in at least two of the circuits. Ralph Northam as well, though, twice, multiple times since Virginia Tech, has sided with the NRA and against Democrats on key votes that have made our communities less safe. He prevented Fairfax and other communities from being able to guarantee fingerprint checks on concealed carry permits, as well as limiting gun show buyback programs that help remove guns off the street, even a law that Tim Kaine vetoed after the Virginia Tech shooting. So I think Ralph and I both have mixed backgrounds on guns, but I believe we're both committed now to common sense reform that will keep us safer. And I think the reason for that is really the organizations out there that have continued to push politicians of all stripes to say, to not accept the old sense of what's possible. There was really a sense from 1994 until for a long time that the Democrats simply wouldn't touch this issue. And I really credit the movements, survivor organizations, and others for pushing both of us, both Ralph Northam and myself, to be stronger on this issue. I think we are now in a position where we have a better chance of really advancing meaningful legislation, though unfortunately, as governor, a lot of that will still be defense of having to veto more permissive laws that come out of the legislature.
Our time is short, so I'm going to ask you to keep future responses to questions as brief as possible. You got an email from someone who says, Tom Perriello talks about free college education, two-year degrees. He notes other countries provide it free, but they're not supporting multi-million-dollar athletic programs. How realistic is it to make free 2 years of education in a system that instead needs to be retooled for a 21st-century economy?
Well, that's exactly the retooling we're talking about, and that's one of the reasons we're prioritizing trade school apprenticeship programs and community colleges. Very few of those have the multimillion-dollar sports programs that they're talking about. We do have a refi program for those taking on four-year student debt that could reduce payments each month by about $50 to $100 a month, and that's really meaningful, and a lot of that money ends up going back into the community. But we really only have two paths today. We have the four-year degree, which is often prohibitively expensive, or we have kind of a vague sense of everything else. In an era of automation, where 35 to 50% of Virginia jobs could be destroyed or partially affected by automation just in the next 15 years, we have to completely rethink our education and workforce training system. People are going to be on a revolving door in and out of training three, four, five times over a career. So instead of going $35,000 in debt once and then trying desperately to pay it off, we're going to need to find a much more agile agile system. I think Mark Warner was ahead of the curve on this, and I think that we can continue to build on both a strong community college system, but also getting back to trades and apprenticeship programs.
Let's talk to politics. 4 or 5 weeks to go. You've raised enough money to be credible at a campaign, and you've put this new ad out. What do you see happening politically? I mean, you've got a couple more debates with Northam. How many are scheduled?
I think we have 3 more debates and maybe 1 or 2 forums. We're in Richmond on Tuesday, I believe, is the next one.
And how's the fundraising going for the final push? You know, they're going. You know, Mr. Northam's going to have a lot of television ads. There's a lot of get out the vote work going on in Alexandria and other places. For him through the Democratic Party establishment that you're running against. Can you match that?
We are matching that. It's great. We really, you can see that the undecideds are breaking our way. The people that are tuning into the race are breaking our way. Even a lot of the folks who had previously been Northam supporters we're seeing at the debates come up afterwards and tell us they're converted. Those are all anecdotal, so you take them with a grain of salt. But, you know, really we do feel like people are very, very excited, both about the intensity with which we've come out to resist the Trump agenda, but also the willingness to put a positive agenda out there that can make a difference in people's lives.
Are you asking them to? You both have criticized Trump extensively, but is this a national? Are some of the national reporters trying to say this is a national race about who's going to stand up to Trump? I looked at the Quinnipiac poll. You're ahead 25% to 21%, 51% undecided. That's a lot. But what's national about this race? Meeting, I guess, Ed Gillespie, if he's the nominee for the Republicans, if he wins June 13th.
Well, I think the first thing is, unfortunately, that our media has just changed where it's much more nationalized. There aren't as many programs like this that can break through and go in depth on actual local and state news. And because people consume so much of their news information from national sources, that means inherently we have to go and do some nationalizing of the race just to reach Virginians. But certainly this is the first real statewide test of what it means to be running in the era of Trump and how much it costs Republicans to have embraced that. And Ed Gillespie made a decision over the last few months to fully embrace Trump's agenda of hate and bigotry. He's had multiple opportunities to show just an iota of courage in standing up against the travel ban, and he wouldn't do it, standing against attacks on trans teens with the executive order and didn't do it. We've had multiple attacks on Virginia jobs through federal freezes and cuts, and he put standing with Trump basically out of fear ahead of standing for Virginia, things like cuts to the Chesapeake Bay. And so I think he's really shown his true color, which is ultimately he really is a D.C. political partisan insider, not someone who cares about Virginia. I think you see on the Democratic side, frankly, from both of us, people who've been born and raised here in Virginia care deeply about every corner of the state and want to make sure that we have an American dream here for everyone, regardless of race, ethnicity, or region.
You have also been criticized, or your campaign has, for raising $2.2 million, of which 56% has come from donors who live outside the state. Some 90% of your opponents' contributions are from in-state. As I said, some people are concerned about what that says, both about your focus on Virginia and your support in Virginia.
Well, look, people should be appalled by our campaign finance system. It is an absolute travesty. There's no other developed democracy in the world that essentially puts our democracy up for sale to the highest bidder. That's why I support publicly financed elections or small donation matches.
Across the board?
Across the board. Access to the public broadcast spectrum. None of this is going to pass in Virginia, I want to be clear. But the starting point is our system is absolutely broken. The problem for Ralph Northam is that that money is coming from Virginia. It's coming from businesses that have business in front of the state of Virginia. And well, many Virginians complain about is the fact that for all of our partisan divides, the biggest donors in Virginia give to both political parties. It's the utilities and the largest developers. They stand in the way of minimum wage increase, which is why Virginia is behind West Virginia on the minimum wage, and certainly on the issue of clean energy jobs and the climate. So I think that the concern of a governor's candidate like Dr. Northam being able to take money from companies that directly have business in front of the state is very concerning to a lot of people. But the whole system is broken. I would like us to do a complete overhaul of it. But we're going to continue to raise and run a grassroots campaign where
we're down to about a minute and a half, Tom.
We need more time.
Well, I wanted to talk about the campaign contribution because I've been looking at the Virginia website that has it all, but Northam contends that most of his are small donor contributions, but he does get those big business donations. You've gotten one person in Charlottesville gave you $500,000.
Yeah.
But let's talk about Northern Virginia, a big audience here. What specifically do you have to offer in Northern Virginia that the that Ralph Northam does not?
Well, for one thing, I've lived here for the last 6 years. So for me, the issues of the needs of WMATA,
in
the
Alexandria,
needs of the metro,
right?
Yeah, in Alexandria, between Delray and Old Town. So, you know, it's something I've understood both as a boss who's had to deal with commuters coming in who don't know if they're going to get in at 7:30 in the morning or 9 in the morning, the need and importance of investing up here, but also the fact that we have – it's easy to talk about the fact that Fairfax Schools, for example, have all this money because it's a rich county, but they also have huge needs. While the concentration of poverty is larger in southwestern Virginia, the volume of people living in poverty is higher in northern Virginia. The number of languages being taught in the public school system. So we need to look at school funding formulas and other things that actually reflect the needs on these school systems, the needs on public infrastructure projects. And that's why I think we've been willing to go with a strong tax reform plan, an investment in universal pre-K that would cover all classes of workers here in Virginia, because we have the challenges in Southside of not enough jobs. But in Northern Virginia, the question is affordability and the ability to actually get to work in a meaningful time to be able to get home and see your kids at night. So I believe our agenda represents an opportunity to help Northern Virginia to address these challenges that get in the way, like transportation and education.
What's your website in case people want to check you out?
TomForVirginia.com.
Tom Perriello, he is a Democratic candidate for Virginia governor. He's a former member of Congress representing Virginia's 5th District Congressman. Perriello, thank you very much for joining us, and good luck to you.
Thank you very much. Thanks to you both.
We'll be joined shortly by Melinda Mars. She'll tell you exactly how to pronounce the name of the town of which she is mayor in Prince George's County. And if you have questions or comments for Melinda Mars, you can start calling now at 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org. Shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show, or watch the live video stream of the broadcast at kojoshow.org. Tom Sherwood, D.C. council members, it would appear a majority of them are concerned about how the Office of Campaign Finance has been conducting its audit, because in the case of Ward 4 council member Brandon Todd, apparently the audit office noticed that there were a lot of inconsistencies with his first campaign, but did not reveal them at all, even as he was running for his second campaign, which, of course, would have provided some ammunition for people who wanted to oppose him. But the city councilors obviously feel that the audit office has a responsibility to provide that kind of information, if it has it, before a person runs for office again.
Well, I don't know. You know, this is not a story or a public policy issue about the Office of Campaign Finance. This is a public policy story about what did Brandon Todd do in two separate campaigns where there's very loose, and I use that loosely, accounting of the money, where it went, how it was spent, even updated contributions or amendments to his reports aren't that very forthcoming in terms of actual real information. So that's the central issue, is this council member from Ward 4 explaining his two campaigns and clearly saying how the money was spent. The council members at large, Ward 6 council member Charles Allen, for example, is saying that we ought to have a law in this city that says you cannot start a new campaign unless you close the old campaign, so that we have less ambiguity about what happens to the money. Several of the council members are concerned that they've got to toughen the reporting requirements so that we will know. It's called financing in open government, so we'll know what people are spending money on, who they get the money from, and not that they just spent $98,000 on get-out-the-vote efforts. That doesn't mean a damn thing. We need to know how you spent the money, and you need to back it up. And in this case, this campaign may need more than just Office of Campaign Finance to look at it.
Our guest, is Melinda Miles. Thank you so much for joining us.
Mayor.
Wait a minute. For those who are not familiar with the city of which you are mayor, tell us a little bit about it, starting with the correct pronunciation of the name.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome.
The correct name, if you're an old timer, is Mount Rainier. And I always say it's rainier in Mount Rainier than anywhere else on earth. You can't get it wrong.
There you go.
For old-timers, do newcomers make mistakes pronouncing it? Do they tend to say Mount Rainier?
Well, I have a campaign manager from North Carolina, and she hasn't said Mount Rainier yet. It's Mount Rainier.
You're fired. I'm sorry, I'm not in a position to fire your campaign manager.
Even though she got it wrong, she was a heck of a campaign manager. So even with Mount Rainier, I've survived.
Well, tell me how this makes you feel. According to the Baltimore Sun, the Howard County School Board agreed to pay nearly $1.6 million in salary and benefits to persuade Renee Foos, the former school superintendent, to retire as school superintendent. $171,000 for her retirement, $278,000 for her pension, $65,000 for her unused days off, and the board agreed to provide Foos lifelong health benefits equal to those received by full retirees of Howard County schools. What is the princely salary that you make for being the mayor of Mount Rainier?
First, can I just say, I'm so glad she's not in Prince George's County.
That's the very first thing
I'm going to tell you.
Okay.
And the second thing I'm going to say is, I did the math a couple of days ago, and I've been involved in Mount Rainier since 1987, and I've gone from $320 a month to a big total of $480. So when we did just the mayor for the last 20 years, I mean my time for the last 20 years, I've made a grand total of $90,000.
For wow. all of those years?
For 20-plus years.
Do you have a separate
Do you regret not shop? Being school superintendent in Howard County?
Well,
I'm sorry.
Well, you That's an excellent question, no.
You know, that Howard County, we want to talk to this mayor. She's got a great story to tell
yes.
here. But that superintendent Howard County thing, they, you know, she was suing the board. There were new board elections to try to get
her
rid
this
of
broadcast.
Her.
No, yes.
She used to be an associate superintendent in Montgomery County, if you want to remember her name. But that's really quite the mess up there. They got 55,000 students, a $800 million budget, mm-hmm. and apparently no one can figure out what to do with it. So let's go back to Mount Rainier.
There were several races across Prince George's County, including Mount Rainier, where you just won re-election. What we might call a hyper-local race in a city in Prince George's County with fewer than 10,000 residents. But it was a very interesting race, and it was hard-fought. You won by 70 votes out of 900 cast. You and your opponent, Jesse Christopherson, a council member since 2013, did not differ that much on issues, but turnout was almost double what it usually is. Why do you think there was so much interest in this race?
I give
full credit to our current president. The revitalization of people in terms of their social impact, their feelings about this entire election atmosphere that we're living in, actually has gotten people, I won't say upset, but I would say that it has pushed them to get involved. And getting into Mount Rainier and getting into Mount Rainier politics becomes very critical because we do have the different ages and stages of Mount Rainier's development. And we've evolved from being almost a sundown city to now being one of the more diverse cities up there. And just look at the council we just elected. We have a person that's of Asian descent. We have someone that's Latina, Hispanic. We have a gay male. We have a new person that was just elected that's a white male. And you have me, a black female, that represents the first black female ever elected as mayor.
Well, you mentioned what I guess our news department here is calling the Trump effect as what causes voters to turn out in such large numbers. And some see a microcosm in Mount Rainier of changes that are happening in D.C. and elsewhere. It's a majority or was a majority black community. It's changing rapidly. Do you have concerns about some of the changes the city has seen and about how some longtime residents are being displaced?
Well, I'd like to say it was a majority white community that became a majority black community that is now becoming a large percent Hispanic community. Do I have some feelings about it? Absolutely. I have
Are those good feelings or bad feelings?
Oh, let me say, there are no bad feelings about Mount Rainier.
Okay.
I believe it's one of the greatest small cities in the entire United States, and I push it that way. I sell it that way.
I've heard that Tom Sherwood agrees with you, but that's another story.
I think you're better Tacoma Park. than Tacoma Park is myself.
And my reaction to that is I didn't move to Tacoma Park because it wasn't my place. I moved to Mount Rainier because it wasn't Tacoma Park.
I'm loving every minute of it. You said on your blog recently that revitalization in Mount Rainier should be inclusive of all its residents.
It should be.
And this is kind of the core issue that Kodjo was talking about, that the people who have lived there want to remain there. They don't want to be pushed out for gentrification. Most people agree with that thought. I would think they understand it. But how do you do that? I mean, how do you
avoid people being pushed out, long-time residents?
Well, I'm coming up with answers every day. I haven't come to the magic answer, but one of the things Luke Chesed brought up again that had been brought up several years ago is looking at some way of coming up with a trust that allows us to have some affordable housing units or whatever. And I think that's going to be one of the ways we need to look at it. The other way to look at it is there's change. And the change by itself means you're going to have different people come in. You're going to have different ways of looking at it. I don't believe Mount Rainier is unique in terms of folks being pushed out to vote.
That's pretty unique.
Well, we're a very unique place.
You didn't take a position on that last January. What is your view now on allowing non-citizens to vote?
I'll tell you the story I told someone at the...
it's not a long one.
It's very short.
Okay.
This is an extremely short one.
Only Charlotte tells long stories.
Someone asked, how did I feel when people of my color were not allowed to vote and how difficult it has been to get there? Would you want to put someone else through that? And my answer was no. So how do I feel? I feel that, as one resident said to me, it should be allowed.
How do you determine citizenship for a non-resident citizen?
I'm not exactly sure what the Board of Elections did, but they managed to make it work. And hopefully it's going to stand.
A lot of development happening in or near Mount Rainier. It's down Route 1 from the growing Hyattsville Arts District, and now a new Whole Foods a bit further up in College Park. Is that having any kind of ripple effect in Mount Rainier?
I think the whole idea of what we're doing is the Gateway Art District as an economic driver. And that economic driver has run from Mount Rainier all the way up. As you may recall, we put in our new police department, the circle, the city hall that we have. It is driving. My problem is Hyattsville got it done first. I have vast property at the corner of Eastern and Rhode Island Avenue, and I repurchased, purchased Pot Hall. That will become the Mount Rainier Civic Center.
What are some of your goals for the city over the next 4 years of your term?
Well, I would love to annex Queenstown Shopping Center. I would definitely want to see the area I just spoke about being redeveloped with affordable housing in it. And I certainly want to get money into the Chacoffers that will build the new Civic Center. But primary for me is for my city to heal.
We did have a split. Oh, I'm sorry.
Talk about
that's
that,
too
please.
Important. Let me stop on the Civic Center. Go back. You want to try to heal the community.
And we need
What's
to.
What's the nature of the split? What was the split?
Well, the split was, you raised the question on non-citizen voting, on becoming a sanctuary city, on all of the things that.
White voters moving in?
I don't think we have a problem with the white voters moving in. It was more of the sanctuary city and the voting. We need to look more at being one community. We claim to be. We talk about our diversity. And so my job now and the job of my community is to actually live it and find ways to get us all to the table and on the same page to talk about those issues. And we will. We have no choice.
Please go ahead.
I want to ask a political question because I know you get involved in politics. Do you have a candidate for governor next year yet?
I'm looking at it.
No is the answer. Okay. Kathleen Matthews
diplomatic. Your county executive is county likely to be one of the candidates.
No,
he's likely to call
one.
You up on the phone.
I can start statewide and move in closer. And I was going to go to Kathleen Matthews next. She's going to be named the party chairman tomorrow in the meeting. Mm-hmm. Are you supportive of her?
I'm still looking.
You're going to get some binoculars. You're going to do so much looking. Now.
Well, I am.
All right.
I think those binoculars might work.
Donna Edwards. And, you know, Donna Edwards on this program acknowledged that she might consider running for it. So it's not just this draft thing suddenly out of the blue. And the state prosecutor, the county prosecutor, whose name? Also Brooks.
Also Brooks.
Her name went out of my head.
Angela Also Brooks.
Where are you on that race?
I'm actually still looking.
Well,
the race doesn't take place in 2018.
We're getting fired up already, though.
Yes, you are. We have great candidates that have put their names in the ring, and I'm going to look at each one of them. And when I look at my candidates, I look at it from a point of what are they going to bring to Mount Rainier?
Don't you run, or used to be the head of the Black Mayors Association?
I was.
So I'm asking this not because of your little town, but because you have statewide influence.
So that's not called the National Conference of Black Mayors?
I've also been mayor of the Maryland Mayors Association.
Right.
Across the entire state, I have.
So you're a power broker.
I don't think I'm a power broker. I think I'm someone who builds relationships. And based on those relationships, I look at what is it going to do for the great city of Mount Rainier.
Has Rashern Baker been a good county executive?
He's been a county executive. And
Ooh.
He's worked very hard.
Oh, has he been a good one?
Well, I haven't measured him yet. I believe there's some issues out there.
You know you're going to be getting a phone call from him sometime as soon as he decides that he's actually going to announce that he's
May I say this?
I'm
waiting on that phone call. I also have looked at some other candidates across the state, and I'm very impressed with a few of those that haven't really thrown their names in, but they have been discussing it, so I have a couple I'm looking at.
We talked about turnout in the mayoral election being a lot more, and you said it was in part the Trump effect, but we didn't ask you whether you thought that the difference, the voting rules allowing immigrants to vote made any difference there at all. That didn't?
I won by 70 votes, according to
out of 900.
Yeah, but in terms of the allowing immigrants to vote, if I'm correct, I think my Board of Elections stated that roughly 25 to 40 registered. And so that wouldn't have even made, that would only brought me down to 30 votes ahead if it was 40. So it did not have the impact that I think was anticipated.
We have a critic, Dawn, by email. I'm a resident since 2000, and I feel that Mayor Miles is a part of the cronyism. She takes credit for citizen initiatives and just green lights them rather than actually starting them. She takes credit for the economic development of our city, but in fact, ask her about the plot on Rhode Island and Eastern. What happened to the EYA and Street Sense? We're going to collaborate on a mixed-use project, but even with the backing of the county and dollars from them, what happened? It's a big hole in the ground, and it's supposed to be a flagship entrance to the Gateway Arts District.
EYA being a very big developer of townhomes and mixed-use projects in the region.
Thank you.
Well, what happened to it? It didn't go through. We had agreement. We had an LDA that was put together.
LDA?
Yeah, Land Development Use Agreement. And for whatever reason, and there were a lot of those, the initiative did not go through. My question would be different. My answer would be different.
Who pulled out? Did the city pull out or did the developer pull out?
No, the developer pulled out. The partner to that. The group was Neighborhood... Somebody. I can't remember the whole name.
What are you trying to do now to... Get a new developer.
We have an RFQ out now to get somebody to say what they will do and how does it fall in line with where we want to go. The initial one has a lot of green issues that we wanted to be addressed. We did not want someone to just come in and build a building. We do want a signature building. We do want it to have a lot of green elements in it. Why did the county pull out? The county didn't exactly totally pull out. They could not carry it the way we wanted it to be carried and was approached by the revenue authority to take on that part of the process. But the other part was, where was the rest of the funding going to come from and whether or not we could carry another building that was right next to it. So the city owns two properties and someone else still owned the third piece that we wanted to have in there.
You know, since the 2008-09 recession, a lot of home prices in Prince George's County dropped terribly. And they dropped some in Mount Rainier, but...
Not like the rest.
I mean, that's one of the issues.
Not like the rest.
You're getting to be a very expensive little community. And what about getting transportation down Rhode Island Avenue to the metro stop? Are there, like, express buses there?
Mount Rainier has probably one of the best transportation systems around. around in a small city. We have a number of Metro buses that come through, and they go from us to Brookland, Rhode Island Avenue. But we're also on the backside of Mount Rainier, because when people look at Mount Rainier, they look at Mount Rainier on Rhode Island Avenue.
Right. There's not
Mount,
Queens Chapel.
There's Mount
there.
Rainier on Queens Chapel Road. There's Mount Rainier on Arundel Road. There are buses that go from there to the Hydesville, West Hydesville Station. Most of my folks that live in many of the apartment buildings actually walk to the metro station.
Is Purple Line anywhere near you?
No.
Okay.
Some people are concerned that as these hip new restaurants open and new residents move in, Mount Rainier will lose that small city neighborly vibe that it has. Are you concerned about that at all?
I don't think we're going to lose it anytime soon. I think it's that small neighborhood vibe that's getting everybody to move out there. It's the fact that the tool shed exists. The caller or the emailer said no initiatives have I brought or put out there. Well, the green initiative out there has been built in part because of myself and some others in the community. Did I go out there and build them with my own two hands? No. But I wrote the grant for the bike co-op. I wrote the grant for the tool shed. Yes, I did work and was one of the founding members for Sustainable Maryland Certified for the green team that we have working out there. Mount Rainier is green. It's not a trend. We've been doing it from the 80s, and we continue to do it now.
Just have a minute left.
In addition to the job you do as mayor, do you have a job? Are you employed? Are you retired from NEA, I know. I think retired from NEA.
I am a totally retired citizen. I retired from the National Education Association in 1994. I ran Family Crisis Center for Domestic Violence for about 4 or 5 years. I also was executive director for Prisons Aid Association of Maryland for about 10, 12 years.
So you're a full-time mayor.
I'm a full-time grandmother, parent,
Last time I checked, you had 16 grandchildren.
I have 17 grandkids, now. And I have
if
5
If you keep having them, have enough, they'll vote you in office the rest of your life.
I have my own team.
Making those big bucks at $420 a month for being mayor.
Well, I have to say that the council voted to give the mayor a raise. I will be going to $10,000 a year.
Oh.
Big bucks.
Melinda Miles, she is the mayor of Mount Rainier, Maryland, Prince George's County. Thank you so much for joining us.
I hope I can pay.
That's it for the show today, but we've got a lot happening over the next week online and on the street. We're taking the show on the road next Tuesday for the next edition of Kojo in Your Community. We'll be hosting a conversation about immigration. It'll take place in Silver Spring at the Public Library on Wayne Avenue. You can find details about the event, which gets going at 6:30 p.m. that day at wamu.org/events. Before that, we'd like to know what you think it means to be a community that's welcoming to immigrants and what you feel the costs of fostering that kind of community are. Share your thoughts over email to us at kojo@wamu.org with the subject line immigration. Don't forget to meet us back here Monday at noon. We'll be exploring what all the uncertainty about health care at the federal level means for those accessing care in our region. That's at noon Monday. Until then, you have a great weekend. Tom Sherwood, you have a great weekend.
Good day.
And thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nandi.
The Kojo Nandi Show is produced by Michael Martinez, Ingelisa Schrobsdorf, Ruth Tam, Avery Kleiman, and Taria Rogers. The engineer is Meg Bunting. Podcast of all shows and audio archives are available at our website, kojoshow.org.